Okay, now we need to talk about the former colonies as they gain their independence. And throughout this discussion, we will be talking about both the former British colonies of North America, which would include Canada and the United States, and the former Spanish and Portuguese colonies of Central and South America. So we're talking about here, of course, Mexico, Central America, Argentina, Brazil, Chile, Peru, Bolivia, Paraguay, Brazil, and the rest. We'll talk a little bit about the Caribbean as well, but not quite as much. Incidentally, I want to point out that most of the Caribbean countries did not fight for independence. Okay, actually, in fact, as far as I know, none of them actually attempted to gain their independence because of the Haitian Revolution, because most of the colonies of the Caribbean were majority slaves. The majority of the population were slaves because, of course, these were all plantation economies based on sugarcane production. Most of the whites on the islands in the Caribbean were scared that if they attempted to gain independence from their colonial masters, that they would face the same kind of slave revolt that Haiti had faced just a few years previous. So as a result, the colonies of the Caribbean remained under the control of the Spanish, French, British, Dutch governments for quite some time. In some cases, they're still under the authority. Some of them have still not gained their independence. Aruba is still under the authority of the Dutch. Martinique is still French. I'm trying to think of some others. The British still have the Virgin Islands. Most of the islands, actually, I would say probably half of the islands of the Caribbean are still actually under the authority of some European country. Probably the other half are independent. The United States actually has a few islands in the Caribbean as well. But anyway, back to our topic for today is the newly independent countries of North and South America. All of these countries seem to have faced the same five basic political problems. Okay, they face some of the similar social problems, which we'll talk about tomorrow. But today our focus is the five principal political problems faced by really all of the newly independent countries of North and South America. The first was constitutionalism. Okay, problems with the constitutions that they wrote. Virtually all of the newly independent countries wrote constitutions, and virtually all of them threw out those constitutions and rewrote new constitutions. In some cases, as many as 9 times. Okay, between 1811 and 1833, Venezuela and Chile had 9 different constitutions. Okay, the United States had 2 different constitutions. As you should know, the United States started when it declared its independence. When the United States actually won the Revolutionary War and sort of started operating actually as an independent country, our Constitution was called the Articles of Confederation. And it created an incredibly weak national government, so weak, in fact, that it was basically ineffective. And that constitution was ultimately thrown out. The reason that this trend exists, that all of these new countries wrote constitutions, of course, is the influence of the Enlightenment, the ideas of the Enlightenment, the influence of the French Revolution, the Declaration of Rights of Man and the Citizen, had the influence of even the Declaration of Independence, the ideals set forth in the Declaration of Independence, and of course frustration with colonial rule, the fact that they were so irritated that they had not had any representation or authority in the colonial system. They wanted to write constitutions to guarantee themselves a voice in their governments. So both the North and the South had problems with constitutions. It turned out that Mexico and South America had many more problems than North America, United States and Canada particularly. This is because the colonies of South America and Mexico did not have much experience with representative government, whereas the British colonies of Canada and the United States, the former British colonies that became Canada and the United States, had some experience with a representative form of government. In the British colonies, the colonists were allowed to elect their local governments, the city council, and the local authorities were elected, and the local government was administered by the colonists themselves. So the British colonists had had some experience with elections and with representative forms of government, whereas the Spanish and Portuguese colonists had never had any experience with this. All of their local officials were appointed by the viceroy. So when these countries became independent, the people didn't have a lot of experience with this new form of government, and as a result, they ran into a lot of problems, which included writing pretty lousy constitutions that sort of created really lofty, idealistic governments that didn't work in practicality. For example, Simón Bolívar, who was the leader of independence in much of South America and wrote most of the constitutions of the newly independent countries of South America, wrote a constitution for Bolivia that created a fourth branch of government. The idea of three branches of government had been an Enlightenment idea that came out of the works of the Enlightened philosophers in France and Britain. And Bolivar decided that government needed an actual fourth branch. This fourth branch would have jurisdiction over the youth, the hearts of men, public spirit, good customs, and republican ethics. Now, can you imagine how this would actually play out in practicality? The fourth branch of government, again, is responsible for the youth, the hearts of men, public spirit, good customs, and republican ethics. So really, it was really lofty and ideal, but it didn't work out in practical terms. Some other problems that the newly independent countries in South America and Mexico faced was the role of the Catholic Church. The Catholic Church had been an integral part of the government and been under the authority of the king in many cases under the colonial regime. But now, as an independent country, they faced problems with whether the church should actually be a part of the new republican government. The ideals of the Enlightenment had said that really there should be a separation between church and state, and that didn't jibe well with the Catholic clergy. So there was this sort of ongoing conflict of what to do with the Catholic Church in these newly independent countries. Likewise, there was a struggle with what to do with the military. The military had led the independence movements. The military was responsible for the independence of these new countries. The generals who had actually successfully gained independence for these countries. You can see two of them actually in the painting in your slide there, Simón Bolívar and José San Martín, were the heroes of independence, and their armies were the heroes of independence. So what do you do with them? Do they have to step down and give up power, or do they maintain their position? The United States faced the same dilemma. George Washington was the general who led American independence. Luckily for the United States, George Washington was willing to really give up his military power and become just a civilian president. But that was largely a decision made by George Washington as the new Constitution was being formed. That didn't happen quite so easily in the newly independent countries of South America. And in many cases, you ended up with the general simply saying, no, I'm not going to respect this constitution. I just fought this war to gain independence for this country. I'm not going to step down now and give up my power. And then also, most of these new constitutions didn't give voting rights to the poor. In order to have voting rights, you had to own property. That was actually the case in all of the constitutions written in both North and South America. And so these masses of poor who didn't own property, many of which had been instrumental in the independence movements, were disenfranchised or lost power under these new constitutions. And they became sort of a dangerous mass that could potentially be used to threaten the power of these new governments and to threaten the power and authority of these new constitutions that actually disempowered the poor. Okay, let's go ahead and transition to the next slide, please. Okay, the next challenge that all of the newly independent countries of North and South America faced was the rise of personalist leaders. We're going to define a personalist leader as an incredibly popular leader who ignores the limits of constitutional government. Okay, these are people who were wildly popular with the masses, and as a result were able to use that popularity to exert more power than they were supposed to. Okay, they were this was a problem in really all of the countries. Not so much Canada. Canada's probably the only one that didn't really face this, but all of the other countries definitely faced this problem. In fact, by 1900, all of the Latin American countries had had a dictator for some period of time, where there was no democratic government. One person had total power, and it was a result of this idea of a personalist leader. Even the United States faced this dilemma with George Washington. Luckily, as I said before, George Washington willingly gave up his authority as the general and gave up much of the authority he could have taken because he was so popular with the general population, and gave that power really, or allowed his power to be significantly limited by a constitution, and then respected that constitution. Now, why was there this trend of personalist leaders in Latin America, but also in North America? Well, first of all, because of the weak constitutional traditions. The constitutions were not respected, for the most part. Almost all of the constitutions were not respected. Eventually, they got good, effective constitutions that were respected, but it took time, and many of the constitutions were thrown out and rewritten and changed, and just constantly back and forth on which constitution would be used. So as a result, the idea of respecting the limits on government the limits that a constitution placed on government was not an established tradition that the South American countries were used to. Next was that almost all of these constitutions, and definitely all of the first constitutions, did not give a voice to the masses, to the poor. In order to vote, you had to own property. So you have this mass population of poor people who have no voice in government. Okay, so they can be manipulated very easily, just like Robespierre in the French Revolution used the mobs of Paris to gain power. These personalist leaders in Latin America could essentially use the mobs of Mexico or the masses of poor of Venezuela or wherever to wield power well beyond what was granted in the Constitution. Next was the role of the military in independence. The military, they'd fought for independence. Okay, the United States fought for independence from Britain. Venezuela and Colombia fought for independence from Spain. In almost all cases, with the exception of Brazil, these newly independent countries had to fight for independence. As a result of these fights for independence, heroes were created, heroic individuals, the leaders of independence. George Washington, okay, Iturbide in Mexico, Simon Bolivar in South America, Jose San Martin in South America, military leaders who were responsible for independence became these heroes, these cult figures, that could wield an incredible amount of power just through their personality and their success on the battlefield. Washington and Iturbide are probably the best two examples. George Washington, of course, was, as I've said over and over again, was willing to give up power and to respect the Constitution. Iturbide was made an emperor. He was the emperor of Mexico for a few years. Okay, so he actually used that personalist power to become emperor. However, just because George Washington was was willing to step down, even though George Washington was willing to respect the power of the, or respect the limits the Constitution placed on his power, doesn't mean the United States escaped this, okay? Washington respected the Constitution. However, Andrew Jackson did not. Okay, our president, Andrew Jackson, was a populist leader. He was wildly popular with the masses. He had been very successful in war, particularly against the Native Americans out west, and he used this popularity to be elected to the White House. And he was by far the best example of an American populist leader. The painting on the right-hand side does a terrific example, sort of depicting this visually. He appealed to the masses, to the common people, the poor people. Okay, that was who saw him, saw Andrew Jackson as their hero. Whereas George Washington and John Adams, the presidents before, had largely appealed to the elite, to the American elite, to the wealthy. Andrew Jackson came in as the hero of the common man. In his first election, when he first ran for president, he actually won the popular vote, but lost in the Electoral College. So that was sort of a demonstration of how he was the hero of the masses, but the elite were not going to let him be president. So he ran for president again, and in this case, he won an overwhelming majority and became our president. And this painting here shows his inauguration as president. And he opened the White House to the masses. He had his inauguration party, and he just opened the doors and let the masses come in and celebrate his inauguration. And so apparently furniture was broken, and it was quite the ruckus in the White House. He said that it took a whole week to clean up after the inaugural party that Andrew Jackson threw for the masses of America. So he was absolutely a populist leader, and he wielded far more power than the Constitution had granted him. He did not respect the authority of the Constitution, and he actually expanded the power of the presidency at the expense of the power of the Supreme Court and the Congress. This trend continued on even a greater scale in Latin America. Of course, in the United States, Andrew Jackson ultimately respected the Constitution, basically. Yes, he did expand the power of the presidency, but he ultimately respected the system of government and the democracy. That was not the case always in Latin America. In Venezuela, the populist leader of Venezuela, you don't need to know his name anyway, actually led Venezuela to break from its union with Colombia and declared Venezuela an independent country, largely through his mass popularity with the poor, and basically ruled Venezuela as a dictator for a little while. In most cases, these populist leaders actually appealed. Their power came from the masses, from the poor, but they tended to be wealthy themselves and tended to protect the interest of the wealthy. So it's sort of interesting. Their power and their popularity was among the poor, and they tended to act to protect the interests of the wealthy. So they were very good propagandists, portraying themselves as the heroes of the poor, but not necessarily actually being the heroes of the poor in reality. There was not a mass expansion in the rights of the poor during this time period. It wasn't like these populist leaders got in power and all of a sudden granted the poor people the right to vote. They didn't. They were actually just really popular and seen as the heroes of the poor, but they didn't really do much to change the situation. Okay. And as I said, ultimately by 1900, all Latin American countries had a dictator for some period of time. Okay, let's go ahead and transition to the next slide. Okay, all of the countries of North and South America faced problems with regionalism, okay, with the country actually breaking up. Obviously, the United States, the most obvious example would be the Civil War. The southern states of the United States broke away and formed the Confederate States of America, okay. Ultimately, that was a failure in America, but it was successful in much of the rest of South America, and even in Mexico. When Mexico gained its independence from Spain, Mexico included all of Central America. Shortly afterwards, though, Central America broke away, and then ultimately Central America broke up into 5 different countries. Venezuela and Colombia were unified when they gained their independence, but very shortly afterwards, Venezuela and Colombia broke up into two different countries. When Argentina gained its independence, it included Chile and Bolivia. Immediately after independence, Chile and Bolivia broke away. Peru as well included Ecuador, but lost that independence. So this sort of trend where these countries would break up into smaller areas continued throughout. Why did they do this? Conflict over tariffs, whether they should charge tariffs on imports and exports because the different regions imported and exported different goods. Taxes, who should pay taxes, who shouldn't. Other domestic and foreign policies. Slavery was a huge issue, not for all of the countries, of course, because slavery was not particularly prevalent in much of the Spanish, former Spanish colonies, but definitely that was the reason for the secessionist movement in America. But ultimately, in the end, all of these countries were affected by regionalism, by portions of the country attempting to break away or ultimately being successful in breaking away. Okay, let's go ahead and transition. Another problem in these newly independent countries was regional and international wars. Virtually all of the countries of North and South America faced war with either a European power or with each other. The United States had to fight the British again in 1812, in the War of 1812. We suffered the humiliation of having the White House and the Capitol burned to the ground. Ultimately, we were successful in the War of 1812, but it was a pretty nasty war. It was a pretty humiliating outcome for the United States. The United States fought the Spanish in the Spanish-American War shortly afterwards. We were successful in that war, called it a splendid little war because it went so well for us. We managed to gain colonies for ourselves. We got Puerto Rico. We got Guam and the Philippines. So we got some islands in the Pacific and the islands in the Caribbean that still belong to the United States, incidentally, although we don't have the Philippines anymore. We gave them their independence, or they pretty much took their independence from us, we should say. But ultimately, the United States did fight the Spanish, fought the British. Mexico had to deal with independence movements. This is more of the kind of regionalism stuff. I should have actually mentioned it on the last slide, but as you probably know, or you should know, much of the western United States was actually part of Mexico. And when Mexico declared its independence, Texas, Arizona, New Mexico, California were all part of Mexico. The first area to break away was Texas. Texas declared its independence from Mexico in 1835. The Mexicans had encouraged Americans to immigrate to Texas, which was part of Mexico, of course, because there wasn't a lot of people up there. And so the Mexicans wanted to settle Texas, so they were encouraging immigration. So Americans were immigrating into Texas, and ultimately it ended up that there were more Americans living in Texas than there were Mexicans. And so in 1835, Texas declared its independence, and Texas became an independent country. It was called the Lone Star Republic. Then shortly afterwards, I'm not sure of the year, but Texas became a state. The United States accepted Texas as a state in the United States, which really ticked Mexico off and provoked a war between the United States and Mexico, the Mexican-American War. Ultimately, the United States invaded Mexico, and we occupied Mexico City and forced the Mexicans to give up or to sell us, actually. We didn't take it. They sold it to us, but they had to give up New Mexico, California, and Arizona. So a huge territorial loss for Mexico, losing Texas, New Mexico, California, and Arizona. We did pay them for it, not very much, and particularly not very much when you consider the fact that gold was found in California. When the Mexicans realized that there was gold in California and they no longer controlled California, they were pretty upset. Mexico also had to face a war with France. France invaded Mexico in 1862 and successfully installed Maximilian as the Emperor of Mexico. So for a brief time, Mexico was back under the authority of an emperor. In 1862, this emperor put in power by the French. They had driven the Mexican president from power and replaced him with an emperor. But luckily, that president, who is pictured in the painting on the slide here, successfully retook power in 1867, defeated the French, and drove Maximilian from Mexico. Again, look at the painting and see if you can't actually figure out what's going on here. You have the Mexican president there in the background, and you can see the crown falling to the ground down there below as he drives off the, I believe, he drives off like the white devils. You can see the sort of the white Europeans being driven out. These are the French people, and the proud Mexicans reasserting their independence. Then down in South America, a lot of regional and international wars there. Chile formed an alliance with Britain to fight Peru and Bolivia. Ultimately, Chile was able to establish itself as the dominant military power in South America. It took away Bolivia's access to the sea and took away a considerable amount of territory that was mineral-rich from Peru. Argentina and Brazil went to war over Uruguay. The ultimate result was that they had to recognize Uruguay's independence. Brazil got into regular conflict with the British over the slave trade. Remember that Brazil had signed a treaty outlawing the slave trade in 1830, but the Brazilians continued to import slaves until the 1850s. So the British Navy patrolled the waters off of Brazil and stopped ships that were importing slaves, and which brought the Brazilians into conflict with the British. Argentina, Brazil, and Uruguay formed an alliance to beat up on Paraguay in the Paraguayan War. So there was just widespread warfare in this region they all had to face. This is a common dilemma. Okay, let's go ahead and transition. Oh, before you transition, I'm sorry, I would like to point out that why these wars were happening. I don't think I said that. The borders between each of these countries were pretty arbitrary because, of course, these are newly independent countries. They'd formerly been colonies. So as far as what territory belonged to who, that was really to be decided by warfare. And then ultimately, they were newly independent countries, former colonies, so the Europeans weren't necessarily ready to accept them as equal members of the world, equal countries in the world. Okay, I'm sorry. Now I'll go ahead and transition. The expansion of the newly independent countries of North and South America brought these the citizens of these countries into conflict with the native peoples. Now, under colonial rule, the rights of the Native Americans had been protected by the colonial governments. So, like for example, in the United States, under the British, expansion westward was limited by the British government. The British had actually made agreements with the natives of the western United States or the western portion of North America and had limited European expansion to the west, signing treaties with the natives, giving them that territory. So west of the Mississippi was Indian territory, and the American colonists were limited in their exploration and expansion beyond the Mississippi by the British government. This was also the case with the Spanish in Argentina. The Spanish government had limited the colonists' expansion into territory controlled by the natives down in Argentina in the Pampas region, which is basically the Argentina's version of the prairies. Once the colonial governments were gone, though, there was no longer this protection for the natives. So these newly independent countries very quickly expanded into Native American territory. The United States, for example, pushed westward, which brought us first into conflict with the Shawnee Nation. The Shawnee had formed an alliance with several other groups along the Mississippi, or in the region along the Mississippi, and actually also allied with the British in the War of 1812. So when we fought against the British in the War of 1812, we were fighting both the Shawnee and the British. The Shawnee were united under two brothers, Tecumseh and the Prophet. The other brother's name was the Prophet. I know it's kind of strange, but at any rate, ultimately, we win the War of 1812, and when we defeat the British in the War of 1812, we also defeat the Shawnee Nation, and that's our first success against the Native Americans. Then in 1830, with Andrew Jackson as president, we get the Indian Removal Acts, and the Cherokee, Creek, and Choctaw are forced to relocate west of the Mississippi. So the Indians that were still in the lands east of the Mississippi were relocated. We're talking about really Georgia here. We're talking about really almost where we live, actually the other side of the Chattahoochee, not quite where we live, but if you just go north of the Chattahoochee, all that territory was Indian territory. It was the Cherokee Nation. The Cherokee had an independent country. Okay, they had a capital, which was up at New Ashoda, which is up near Canton. It's about maybe, I would say, 30 miles from here. That was the capital of the Cherokee Nation. It was a democracy, a republic. They had a constitution. They had a Congress and a president. The president's house was up also in New Ashoda. It's all still there. You can actually go see it. It's pretty neat. So it was, the United States was the sort of on this side of the Chattahoochee River, and the Cherokee Nation was on the other side. And then in 1830, through some very corrupt dealings and some very corrupt maneuvers, the United States managed to get some quasi-legal documents which showed that the natives had agreed to relocate, which really meant that we were basically forcing them to relocate, and the Cherokee Creek and Choctaw were moved west of the Mississippi and ultimately settled in the far western portion of what is now the United States. The next conflict was with the Indians of the prairies, the Great Plains. Remember way back when we talked about when the Europeans showed up in the first place, we talked about the French in Canada, that the French had partnered with the natives in the fur trade. And as a result, the natives had become familiar with guns and had a regular source of guns and horses. And the natives of the American prairies had become very, very adept at the use of cavalry and the use of firearms. So they were fighting on the back of horses with guns with a tremendous amount of success. These are the Sioux, Comanche, Pawnee, and Kiowa Indians. And they offered a very successful resistance against U.S. expansion. The Comanche were the first, though, to succumb. They actually occupied the lands that were once part of Mexico. In 1865, the U.S. Army successfully defeated the Comanche Nation and forced them onto a reserve. In 1870s, the U.S. Army successfully defeated the Sioux, again forcing them onto a reserve. In the 1880s, we defeated the Apache. So just successfully working our way west, defeating one Native American nation after the other, and as we defeated them, forcing them to sign treaties that relegated their population to pretty much the worst of worst land, which became these Indian reservations. And ultimately is why we have all these casinos on Indian reservations, because that's the only way they can make a living, because the land is so junky that there's really no other way to make a living except to build casinos and bring people in to gamble. But the same story occurred in Argentina and Chile. In the 1870s, the Argentinian and Chilean army were having some success in defeating their Native Americans, the natives of the Pampas. They had the same issue. The natives of the Pampas had adopted horses and had adopted guns and become quite successful, cavalry force, and had defended their independence and actually held territory very close to the capital of Argentina at Buenos Aires. But in the 1870s, the Argentinian army and the Chilean army adopted new military technologies, which allowed them to defeat their Native American populations in much the same way that the American army defeated the Apache, Sioux, Comanche, and Kiowa. Ultimately, the United States, Argentina, and Chile is able to just pretty much push the natives out and put them into really marginal lands, relegate them, in the case of the United States, to reservations. Then Mexico also faced problems with its native population. In the case of Mexico, though, it was a population that had already been conquered, already been subdued, the Mayan, but they rebelled against the Mexican government. Mexico fell into a civil war in the 1830s, and this allowed for a successful rebellion by the Mayans of the Yucatan Peninsula. Yucatan Peninsula is that sort of shoe-shaped peninsula that sticks up off of the southern portion of Mexico. So the Mayans rebelled, and in 1847, in what were called the Caste Wars, the Mayans of the Yucatan Peninsula declared their independence, and they became the Empire of the Cross. And they managed in in some remote areas to maintain this independence all the way up until 1901. So that's pretty amazing. 1847, the wars happen. Mayans declare their independence from Mexico, and then manage to hold on to some small areas of independence all the way up until 1901. The painting on this slide I'd like you to take a look at is actually Custer's Last Stand. This is the Custer fighting against the, I think it's the Sioux. I might be wrong, but I'm pretty sure it's the Sioux. If it's not the Sioux, it's the Apache. But at any rate, Custer was a general in the U.S. Army, and he was attempting to defeat these natives, and ultimately he himself was defeated, and his army was routed. But that was the last major success of Native Americans against the U.S. Army. After that, the U.S. Army was able to pretty much drive westward and defeat all of the Native American nations. Okay, let's go ahead and transition to the next slide. You have a reading assignment that you'll need to complete in the book, and then you'll be done.